It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tonight we bring you part two of our special holiday broadcast of readings from the 2004 Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism, held this month in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Writers and journalists from across the nation gathered at the conference to read from their reporting, conveyed in story form. Different realities, political and personal, surprising and sometimes sad, captured in narrative. Tonight we'll hear the story of a divorced father telling his daughter he's dating again, the story of a mother watching her son's first t-ball game, and a story from Tracy Kidder about traveling with humanitarian Dr. Paul Farmer. Tonight on Point, the stories of our world, Narrative Journalism 2004. We begin tonight with a reading from independent broadcast journalist Jay Allison, a five-time Peabody Award winner. Here he reads from an essay he wrote for the New York Times Magazine called Grilling Me Softly.
Seen the living room of the house I've been occupying for several years since the end of my long marriage. During that time, no dates. My oldest daughter, Lily, a 10th grader, is visiting. We've finished dinner and are sitting around, and it feels like a good time to mention that I have finally had my first date. As I suspected, she has a flood of questions, which I have decided in advance not to answer. Instead, I start taking notes. Me. Did you get my email? Lily. No. Me. I wrote you about how I actually didn't end up alone on Thanksgiving. I had a date. Lily. Hey, give me five. Who? Me. Well, I'm not telling. I didn't want to tell you any lies about where I was, but I'm keeping details personal for now, which will drive you crazy. I'm sorry. Lily, come on. Just tell me her name. Do I know her? Is she from here? Wait, how old is she? Just tell me she's over 30. Uh-oh. It's one of our babysitters, isn't it? Ooh. Or wait. Is it a guy? It's a dude. You're gay. I knew it. You think I'm gay? Yeah. Are you going to see her again? Oh, I know. It's Mom. Me, I knew you'd say that. Lily, did you share a room? Did you drive together? Did you hold hands or was it a one-night stand? Does she know me? Why won't you tell me? Are you two engaged? Me, we could be married. They voted to allow gay marriage in Massachusetts. Lily, I'm going to kill myself. Where did you meet? Did you pay for her dinner? Is she your girlfriend? Dad, you have to tell me. If you don't tell me, I'll get pissed and do what I did to Mom's boyfriend and egg her car. You have to work with me here because I can turn on you in an instant. Do the other kids know? I'm going to tell them. I'm going to tell them you're leaving them and going to Poland with her like Uncle Spencer did and never coming back. Wait, is she in my grade? She probably is, oh God. Me, she's not. Lily, does she dye her hair? Does she wear makeup? Is she hot? Does she smoke? Wait, that's an issue for me. Me, you mean you don't like smokers? Lily, not in stepmothers, only in boyfriends. Wait, I'm going to check your caller ID. Beep, 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 beep. Okay, Jens Barawe, who's that? He happened to be my divorce attorney. That's her. Jens. So she'd be Jens Allison. Ooh. Is she coming for Christmas? I may have to fight her. What are your intentions toward my father, bitch? Me, you're tough. Lily, is she one of the first five people I would guess? Is she Madonna or Britney Spears? Is she Skanky? Or is it Alison Krauss? Is it my English teacher? Does she have a gut? Is she good at poker? What's on her iPod? Do you even know her last name? Does she have any scars? Me, you haven't asked if she has a tattoo. Lily, well, does she? Does she know you have a long hair on your nose? Does she work in public radio? Does she know who she's messing with? Does she wear glasses? Is she a pothead, an alcoholic, a psycho? Does she play games with your heart? Did you watch the sunset over a lake? Did the night watchman catch you hooking up? Does she wear hats? Does she know Britney Spears? Can she get me tickets? Is she any good for things like that? Me, it was just a date, you know. Lily, she's not a Yankees fan, is she? Is she one of your old girlfriends, like the freckly one from Indiana Jones? Does she kiss on the first date? Would she like me? Is she taller than me? Me, I'll tell you one thing. We drove on Route 35. I'm not saying what state that's in. And there was no one around, and it was late at night and rainy. We stopped the car and turned up the radio and danced in the road. Lily, high five! Well, as long as she makes you happy, Dad, I can't hate her too much. I can still egg her car, though.
Independent broadcast journalist Jay Allison reading from his essay, Grilling Me Softly, written for the New York Times Magazine. Next up is Denene Brown, who's recently returned from Toronto, where she was Canada Bureau Chief for the Washington Post. Tonight, Denene Brown reads from a story about an Inuit sweat lodge in Labrador.
They pull down the curtain and throw water on the hot stones called grandfathers. The steam rises fiercely, chasing out the demons in the tent. One takes refuge in my lap and feeds me fire soup. It goes down painfully to my lungs and stomach and then out my pores. I don't have enough strength to cough. Here on a carpet of pine needles, in a canvas tent, here in a forest near the northeast tip of Canada, away from city lights and running water, I sit and learn of the grandfathers and the earth's bosses and spirits. I came to this campsite of the native Innu people. Someone told me they saw something in my spirit and asked me if I'd like to join an Innu sweat lodge, a traditional sauna tent into which the Innu climb to purge the hurts of their souls and emotions. I, not knowing what to expect, consented. An elder woman, Elizabeth, hands me her cotton skirt and blouse. I change my clothes, jewelry, and boots in her tent. Jewelry in the sweat heat would only singe my skin. I take off my glasses and follow the stranger blindly through the darkness, away from the campground where the trees lean against the midnight blue sky. The wind speaks, gravel crunches underneath my feet. I walk without talking. The night is cold, the kind of coldness that old people used to say you could catch your death in. Still, I follow the path to the white canvas tent. Outside it, men greet me. I do not know their names. They are gathering great round stones, red with heat, being cooked in the bonfire all night. They roll the stones with a pitchfork into the tent and drop them into a black hole. I am directed to enter to the left. That is the direction in which the world turns. I'm told to put an offering on the rocks, which they call grandfathers because they represent the ancestors. An offering is simple, moss or tobacco. I have neither. So I'm directed to go to a far corner on a bed of pine needles. I climb gingerly around the red stones. I look around. Four nearly naked men and a woman are sitting around the stone grandfathers. Next to the hole are wooden bowls of water. And without warning, the eldest of the men hurls a cup of water on the grandfathers, and they hiss, sending up a cloud of steam that fill every cubic inch of the tent. It is sealed, held up by young birch trees and tied with twine. The elder prays in the Innu language, asking for guidance. Now he sings the song of the ancestors. The steam subsides. The tent is pitch black. Outside, nightbirds sing. Then more water and more steam, and it pushes me back again, and I fall to the floor, and I think I'm suffocating. I know I'm suffocating, but the only way out is over the red stones and two people to my right. I claw at the bottom of the tent, seeking air, needing air. One of the men begins telling a story. I'm an alcoholic, he says. I've been sober 19 years. When I was drinking, I did bad things. I beat my wife. I killed a man. It is a man near the tent opening, revealing himself to others and to the spirits. It is this man I have to pass to get out. More water, more steam, more words. Another man starts. I've been sober 18 years, but it is hard. In the sweats of old, the elders would see visions of where the next meal would come, where to hunt for caribou, fox, and partridge, and porcupine. In this world, natural law rises above man's law. There are five bosses: the elder, the black bear, the caribou, the owl, the fish. In this lodge, you pay respect to those bosses. The black bear is the boss, an elder tells me, because he understands and he smells and he hears. And if we encounter a black bear in the wilderness, we would just say, Kanachi, Kana, Namasham. Don't bother us, grandfather, because he understands. More words, more steams. For 3 hours, the spirits are unrelenting in that tent. The steam is an oppressor. As I listen, fighting for breath, I somehow come to understand the language of nature's law. And the stories of the bear and the grandfather stones begin to make sense. I listen to the voice of the wind, but I'm still fighting for breath. I continue to search for air. I claw the ground in the drenched darkness ever so subtly with my right hand while listening to the stories of the elders. I want to get out. I do not care the dirt is going under my fingernails and my hair is matted in pine and my clothes are drenched as if I've fallen into a mountain stream. The elder is still talking of hurts, and they are big hurts, hurts like stones on his shoulders. He reminds me of the ministers in the Baptist church on Sunday mornings, turned afternoons, the sermons that never seem to reach a benediction, no matter how many amens the church mother shouted. Then I find it, a slit between the cold ground and the taut tent. Ever so subtly, a 2-inch breeze blows toward my face, which is on the ground by now. I lie still, breathing the small purse of air. Let the elder preach. Now I want to hear more.
Brown recently returned from Toronto, where she was Canada Bureau Chief for the Washington Post. She's now a style reporter for the Post. We'll hear more readings in just a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're listening tonight to writers reading their own works of narrative journalism. This year, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Tracy Kidder told the story of his travels in Haiti and beyond with an unusual physician. Here, he reads from his book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, Healing the World, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer.
We've been on this long hike. We still have to get back to Zami La Santé. The sun is setting by the time we finally leave Alcant's family. Gray clouds billow over the mountains we crossed earlier today. The westering sun is rebuking us, says Farmer. He and Tijan confer. They decide we can't walk back the way we came, not across rivers and over steep paths in the dark without a flashlight. What they mean is that they don't think I'd make it. I'm not pleased that they think this, but I'm relieved that they do. We arrive back in Kaas around dusk. An old man rides down the dirt street on a horse, then a young man on a motorbike, whom Farmer stops. He asks the driver if he'll give one of our party, the pharmacist, a lift to Kaj, and the young man says he will, but for $100. What's your name? Says Farmer in Creole. Jackie, he replies. Then he asks, are you Dr. Paul? Yes. We know your machine eats gas, and we'll replace it. We brought some money for a family here, and they are living in squalor, unlike you, Jackie. And if you get sick, I won't ask you for $100. A little crowd is gathered to listen in. Now everyone, including Jackie, laughs. So it's settled. The pharmacist will ride with Jackie back to Kaj and send a truck for Tijan and Farmer and me. Farmer didn't even break a sweat in the previous hours of walking, and now he feels like walking some more. Everyone thinks I'm unhealthy, he says to me. In fact, healthy as a horse. So we won't wait in Kaas for the truck. Tijan and Farmer and I will walk along the dirt road that leads from Kaas to Tomond, the route the truck will have to take. We stroll out of the village in fading light. The air is merely warm now, the kind of air that I'll remember on winter nights in northern places and think I must have dreamed. Soon, there being no electrical lights for miles and miles in any direction, the stars pop out en masse, bright enough, it seems, to faintly light the road. This is nice, Farmer says to me. A break from my clinic, from airplanes. I know your feet hurt, but I do in many ways prefer walking. A cozy feeling seems to spread from him. It's as if we're three kids out after bedtime, and we can say whatever is really on our minds but don't have to. I sing a snatch of an army marching song. You had a good home, but you left. You had a nice bus, but you left, sings Farmer. Roosters crow in the night. Now and then a dog barks. Then we hear a strange sound coming toward us, like something scraping the road. What is it? Farmer asks Tijan. Tijan says, Job Pal. The literal translation is, its own job. He means, don't ask. In a moment, the shapes of a pair of men appear, dragging some sawn lumber down the road toward Kaas. A few minutes later, we hear a squeaking sound approaching. Farmer asks Tijan what it is, and Tijan answers more emphatically, Zafe Bundal, which means its own ass. That is, he's telling Farmer to shut up and mind his own business. A moment later, the shape of a person on a squeaky old bicycle passes in the starlight. This continues. Another figure passes us, and Farmer says, Bonsoir, and Tijan shushes him, then issues these instructions. If someone passes you at night and doesn't speak, you too must remain silent. But if the person asks who you are, you must say, I am who you are. And if the person asks what you do, you must say, I do what you do. What's the danger? Farmer asks. Tijan says, you might be talking to a demon who will steal your spirit. Then you'll wake up in the morning with diarrhea and vomiting, and the doctor will say you have typhoid or malaria. But in fact, the problem will be more complex. You should take the medicines, says Tijan, but then you should also go to a voodoo priest. We stroll on. Farmer says that Tijan's discourse has reminded him of his first ardent explorations of Haiti and of the dozens of voodoo ceremonies he attended. Contrary to almost everything he'd read about their luridness, he found them long and boring. The majority were held because someone was sick. He asks Tijan his opinion. Are half of voodoo ceremonies attempts to drive away illness? Three quarters, says Tijan. Isn't it amazing, Farmer says to me, that this simple fact has eluded all the many commentaries on voodoo? We've walked 3 hours from Kaas, 11 hours in all today. When I finally feel as though I can't go any farther, when I say so, Farmer calls a halt. I'm grateful that he doesn't tease me. We sit down on the side of the lumpy dirt road on the crest of a hill facing east. I have a candy bar, and we share it like a trio of Boy Scouts under the stars. Tijan points out a blinking red light far away, a radio tower across the border in the Dominican Republic. Staring at it, I hear Farmer's voice beside me, his gentle doctor's voice, asking how I feel. I tell him the truth, tired but feeling fine. And then, clear of all his duties for now, his last patient of the day attended to, he lies back on the ground and stares at the stars. There's Orion's belt. From somewhere in the valley below us comes the sound of drums. I recall the time I spent here in the Central Plateau with the American soldiers, and I remember the sound of voodoo drums wafting into the army barracks in Mirbalay at night, and how unsettling it was to some of us sitting there in all its mystery. I'm sure we'd have felt different if we'd known we were probably hearing ceremonies to cure the sick. For myself right now, I like the sound, like so many hearts beating through a single stethoscope. Thanks.
Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Tracy Kidder reading from his new book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, Healing the World, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer. Kramer is an author and director of the Nieman Program on Narrative Journalism. He dedicated this reading from his book, Three Farms, Making Milk, Meat, and Money from the American Soil, to his good friend and writer, Noel Perrin, who passed away this fall.
Late in the summer of 1910, shortly after his 90th birthday, an ailing old Yankee, Joshua Topman by name, feeling caged by the narrowness of his round between sick bed and dining room in his son's farmhouse, peered out the window at the high, even, and lush greenness of a field of second-cutting hay just across the road, and he proclaimed to his son, "Frederick, I want to mow again. I want to mow once more while I still can." According to Topman family lore, whether Joshua still could was already a question. Nevertheless, Frederick went about preparing for the chore. The mowing machine was especially dear to Joshua until he was in his 60th year. Like his forebears for generations, old Joshua had harvested hay by hand with scythe and hay fork, together with a gang of neighbors needed to get the job done. Starting with a different farm each year, they'd moved on to return the favor at every farm in the neighborhood, laboring hard by day, eating together in the evenings. In the 1860s, country newspapers were filled with news of trials of a progression of mowing machines. The reports grew more and more positive. The problems, clogging, protecting blades from obstacles, got solved. Joshua was said to have bought the first machine in Conway, Mass., perhaps not till the late 1870s. The purchase was aggressive. It freed him in a way, placed him outside the constraints of neighborly interdependence. His farm prospered. News spread. The neighbors couldn't have afforded to wait too many years before they followed suit and equipped themselves to mow on their own, too. Joshua had been first, and Joshua loved mowing. The old man was ailing, but he tottered out of doors to supervise as Frederick, who was 54 then, hauled out the mowing machine, harnessed up the team. When the horses were in place, Frederick himself climbed up onto the cast iron seat. He drove the horses across the road and, after pausing to observe the rolling field, moved in a way through the high grass, engaged the cutter bar, and mowed around a long and perfect rectangle, defining for his father the easiest mowing on the farm, 2 acres flat, free of trees and ledgy outcroppings, squared to eliminate the point rows of irregular fields. Coming back to the dooryard, Frederick stopped to chat for a moment with a farmhand known in family lore as Old Deck, a quiet and usually temperate man, somewhat younger than Joshua, who during Joshua's decline had been doubling as nursemaid. Frederick instructed Deck to walk behind as the old man mowed so close that if he topples off the seat, you'll get to him quick enough to set him up again. These precautions taken, Frederick climbed down, helped Joshua up in his place, and watched as the procession headed back for the mowing. Frederick's team of white horses in the lead, then Joshua seated now with reins in hand, then Deck striding behind and to round things out, one nine-year-old boy who was excited to see his grandpa in action. The boy, an old man now, says he would be surprised if a cow dog named Topsy hadn't been trailing after him at the end of the parade. The old man didn't topple that day. He mowed around and around the hayfield. Frederick had squared for him doing something useful, celebrating routine, which could go on and on a late summer's day in his 91st and final year of agricultural life. The boy who'd run alongside the mowing machine close in behind Deck was Frederick's baby, the youngest of his six children, Joshua's grandson, Raymond Topman. Raymond was to take over the place in his own time, farm for half a century, and pass it on to his son. It's September now. We're in the same farmhouse, in the same dining room. Raymond is lounging, reclining, stretched into an elongated Z in a large brown plastic-covered easy chair. He's short, 75, blessed, as were his father and grandfather, with a full head of hair and vital pale blue eyes. And also, like father and grandfather, he is built solidly like an inverted trapezoid, broad end up. He looks like a man who was rugged once. You'll see, he's warning me. You get to a certain age and your chest falls. Makes you look smaller. Ray points out the window to the lush seeding of alfalfa and timothy grass. That wants mowing, he says. And go find Ray Topman. I mean, go find Noel Perrin.
Mark Kramer is writer-in-residence at the Nieman Foundation at Harvard University and director of the Nieman Program on Narrative Journalism. Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Helen Ubinas is a columnist for the Hartford Courant. Tonight, she reads a column she wrote about her frustration and grief at having to attend the funeral of yet another young victim of urban violence.
I just came from a 12-year-old's funeral, so you will forgive me if I am not as diplomatic as perhaps I should be. If I offend your sensibilities when I say that I am tired. So damn tired of going to a kid's funeral and hearing adults tell each other that they need to step up. Well, guess what? We're at a funeral again. It's too late. It was too late for Errol Forrest, lying there in his casket, completely unrecognizable as the little boy with the big smile. It was too late for Quan Salmon and Dennis Faniel and so many other little and not so little boys whose deaths were supposed to change things. And it's too late for all the kids who die in this city just like they lived, alone. It takes a village. My God, how many times have I heard that from someone standing at the pulpit, looking down at a casket too small to represent a full life? Guess what, village? You failed. You failed Errol and you failed Alan, 12-year-olds left to wander the North End on their own. And now Alan is charged with killing his friend, and the village has dressed up and come to church and told itself Errol is living a better life because he is walking with God. Walking with God? Does that really make anyone feel better? Because it's never worked for me. It didn't work Thursday when I was sitting in church surrounded by kids, so many kids, some with legs dangling from the pews, who wore their brothers' jackets and giggled because they didn't know what else to do, who were still trying to get comfortable with those hard masks they need to survive. They cracked, but not until one little boy went up there to sing Amazing Grace. And then everyone lost it. The boy who came in sucking his thumb, the boy who kept asking his big sister if she was okay when really what he meant was that he wasn't. The girl kept repeating, "He do not look right. He do not look right." And she was right. He didn't. There's no way to put together a head after a chunk of metal rips into it, after doctors try to fix it and find that they can't. The face in the casket wasn't the face in the big picture nearby. It was swollen and artificial looking. It seemed impossible that the smile that everyone talked about was under there somewhere. There is something about kids. They are too innocent to lie, to sugarcoat the truth, to be careful not to make the adults look bad. So one by one, his friends told stories of Errol being out late, walking the streets at night, breaking a window, and wondering if he was going to jail. He was so scared that day, they said. And they talked about his step-grandfather looking for him when he noticed he wasn't home, riding him back to school on his bicycle, riding back when the school said there was a problem with Errol. The applause for his grandfather echoed throughout the church. His family thanked him over and over again, aunts and uncles and cousins, and he was gracious, much more gracious than I would have been, surrounded by people who thanked me instead of helping me. Why weren't you there for him? Why didn't you help him? Why didn't you step up when his mother didn't? She loved him, she said in the letter she sent from jail. But you know what? You can't love a little boy the way he should be loved from behind bars. You just can't. That's when everyone needed to step up, when the village needed to come together, not here in this church packed with empty promises. I know we're supposed to try to understand, to forgive, to hope that next time we'll be better. Life is complicated. People make mistakes. But sitting there at a 12-year-old's funeral, things suddenly got a lot clearer, a lot less complicated. He shouldn't be dead, and he didn't have to die, and there is nothing anyone can say to change that truth.
Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Helen Ubinas, columnist for the Hartford Courant. We'll have more readings after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we're hearing some of the country's best writers reading from their works at the 2004 Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism. Next up, we'll hear from Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Louise Kiernan, who writes for the Chicago Tribune, here remembering her son Connor's first T-ball game, what it meant for him, and what it meant for her.
I didn't know to bring camp chairs. I didn't know I should sign up for snack duty or when it was appropriate to cheer. I didn't know that a coat perfectly adequate for a Saturday morning spent running errands would leave me shivering on a Saturday morning devoted to watching six innings of T-ball. I didn't know T-ball had six innings. Last weekend marked my first outing as the parent of a child who plays an organized sport. I should have been better prepared. The season opener between our local Mariners and Indians had been a long time coming, and not just because my son had been reciting the Mariners' schedule every morning off the sheet posted to the refrigerator. Saturday's game really began some 2 summers ago with the casual garage sale purchase of a plastic bat and ball set. Little Tykes somehow spawned a passion so deep that by this spring, almost every clement afternoon was spent hitting and catching balls in an undersized yard where the patio chairs and slide had been converted to bases, and the boy who circled them issued his own running commentary with lines like, "Here comes Corey Patterson rounding third. He's fast, but not as fast as Connor Johnson." I knew I had become the mother of a child who barked at me, "Short chopper, stays alive," but I had no idea what it meant. What it meant, it turned out, was a queue of minivans next to a field and boxes of Dunkin' Donuts munchkins on the bleachers and fathers pacing the sidelines and younger brothers and sisters dragging sticks in the packed dirt and rolling down the neighboring hill. In the center of it all, at least in my view, was number 13 sitting on the bench. He wore the smallest size uniform you could buy, but it was still so big that when the shirt came untucked, it unfurled to his knees. We rarely witness the moments our children change. Of course, the scrapbook milestones, the first step, the first day of school, the first dance, are duly recorded. But most of the time, a particular joy or habit, smile or quirk, slips away and is replaced before we can mark it, like the music on an AM radio station. A new song begins before the last one ends, drowning out the final notes with an insistent new beat. You suddenly realize that you haven't heard your two-year-old sing himself to sleep for a couple of weeks, or you notice the stroller has been sitting unused in the trunk of the car the last few outings. You register that your child has somehow mastered the use of a fork or grasped the words on a page without knowing precisely how and when this event occurred. This time, though, I was there. The game had consumed most of my son's conversation for a week. He approached it with all the gravity of the World Series. Did the Indians have a home field advantage? What would happen if the Mariners lost? What would happen if he didn't play well? What would happen if he forgot how to catch the ball, dropped his glove, couldn't find his hat? He was nervous and eager to enter a world that seemed in some way to promise him, as if he were Pinocchio, transformation into a real boy. I wondered what that transformation would mean. Were we on the verge of the headlong plunge into burp jokes and sweaty socks and shoulders that shrugged their way out of a hug? The night before the game, he set out his glove and ball on his bedroom dresser. He had on his uniform 3 hours before the game was due to start. I'm not sure if it was the second inning or the third, whether the score was 6-3 or 8-5, or whatever of the many gallops it took before the final tally reached 23-22 Mariners. T-ball resembling professional football more than professional baseball in terms of scoring. But my son stepped up to bat for the first time. He swung and hit and began to run, legs pumping toward first base, his face intent beneath a batter's helmet so oversized he resembled a bobblehead come to life. He beat the throw to first and stood there, serious, watching the next play, waiting for the coach to tell him to run again. He didn't look happy or scared or proud. He just looked like a boy playing t-ball. And first base seemed a long, long way from home. Thank you.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Louise Kiernan of the Chicago Tribune. Walt Harrington is an author and head of the Department of Journalism at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Here he reads from his book, The Everlasting Stream, a true story of rabbits, guns, friendship, and family.
There's no sway in Carl's walk. He holds his gun at his side and parallel to the ground in his right hand and walks through a wide field that the sun is revealing in shades of sand to ginger to bronze to henna, and a good half mile away, gunmetal gray that demarcates the tree line along Skaggs Creek from a silver horizon that becomes a stunning delft blue sky. As he walks, Carl's body stays perpendicular to the ground and his legs seem to move only below their knees. His thighs, huge torso, even his arms seem to remain still. It is the most sedate walk you will ever see. The morning is bright and cold, one of our rare hunting mornings when it's below freezing, 26 degrees. When we met at the dog kennels behind Bobby's house at 6:30 this morning, the grass was coated with a misty glaze of ice and the blades were curling under the weight. At the land behind B.C. Witt's farm, the place the men took me my first morning of hunting 12 years ago, when I didn't know where I was or even what was north, south, east, or west, the icy glaze has melted and distilled into tiny dollops of water that are sticking to our hunting pants like burrs and glistening in the sun. The dogs are hopscotching in the weeds, sniffing and gusting steam. Earl stops, stretches, puffs his chest, peeks his nose, emits a loud, long, "Arr!" drops his head and tears off on a trail with the other dogs howling behind him. A rabbit bounds between Carl and my son Matt, and before Matt even lifts his gun to his shoulder, Carl shoots, lowers his gun to his side, and begins that sedate walk toward the dead rabbit. I'm hunting with glasses for the first time this morning. My vision far away isn't too bad, but in middle age, my eyes just can't see close up very well anymore. I've been wearing reading glasses for years, but finally bought a pair of multifocals, the progressive kind that hide the reading lens and the larger lens for vanity's sake. I was shocked at what I had been missing. Not only can I read the odometer in my car and see the hairs on the back of my hand again, but in the hunting fields this morning, my glasses have reminded me of my father's admonition that the world is best perceived from either long distance in a beautiful blur or on hands and knees before the flower, looking one petal at a time. The beautiful blur is all around me. Looking across the fields and forests, I see an infinite array of shades in the palette of cool season colors: grays, gunmetal, stone, pewter, moth, tans, sand, cinnamon, ochre, wheat, yellows, bronze, copper, camel, gold, browns, ginger, mocha, amber, dun, reds, henna, russet, salmon, plum. When I stop and look, I realize there are as many shades in nature's narrow band of fall to winter colors as there are points between the ends of a line. With my new glasses, though, the petals now come into anatomical focus. I see the crease that bisects the length of a blade of Johnson grass. I see the cottony hairs on the stem clusters of broom sedge and realize why its genus name from the Latin is andropogon, bearded like an old man. I see what looks to be blackberry briars and realize they're actually dewberry. Their stems are round, not square, although I'm still not very good at telling the difference. Just now, as Carl and Alex and I walk through a field of weeds and briars on our way to hunt a tall forest, I say, "Blackberry bushes. Ought to be a rabbit nearby." Alex glances at the bushes. "They're dewberry. I used to eat dewberry pie as a boy." I bend over and examine the stems. Alex is right. They're round, not square. Alex posts outside the forest, and Carl and I enter the tall wood where poison ivy and Virginia creeper ensnarl the trees as they do the trees at another hunting spot we frequent. I now know that if the roots grow into the tree in thick, hairy tendrils, the vine is poison ivy. Don't lean back against that tree. If the roots lack tendrils, it's Virginia creeper. Lean back, relax. Among the trees, I see only one pine. It looks like a hemlock. But now, using my new lenses, I can see that the backs of its needles aren't white striped, but yellowy green. It's an American yew. Thank you.
Walt Harrington reading from his book, The Everlasting Stream, a true story of rabbits, guns, friendship, and family. Close tonight with Adam Hochschild, an author and co-founder of Mother Jones magazine. Here he reads from a piece that was published as a magazine article and is part profile of his Uncle Boris and part memoir. It was later used as the beginning of his book, Half the Way Home, a memoir of father and son.
The most vivid memories I have of my childhood are of the summer evenings when Boris's plane took off. Boris Vasilievich Sergeyevsky, captain in the Imperial Russian Air Force, World War I fighter pilot, winner of the Order of St. George, which entitles the bearer to a personal audience with the Tsar any time of day or night, test pilot for the Pan American Clippers of the 1930s, opera tenor, gourmet, lover, horseman, and adventurer, was, miraculously, my uncle. One day he had flown his plane down from the sky and, to the complete shock of all her relatives, had married my father's sister, Gertrude. She was then 41 years old and had almost certainly never even kissed a man before. From that point on, life in our family was never the same. Gertrude, my father, and their brother all spent the summer with their families in the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York. When I was a boy, in the years right after World War II, Boris was retired from test piloting. He now operated an air charter business in New York City, flying people anywhere they wanted to go in a 10-passenger Grumman Mallard that could put down on land or water. During the summer, Boris spent the week in New York. For the weekend, he flew north to join his family. Then, on Sunday evenings, he took off to return to the city. The plane sat on a concrete apron next to the lakeshore. Gradually, people began to arrive, a few passengers, family members, friends, and spectators, coming on foot or by car through the woods or by motorboat over the lake. When his passengers had climbed on board, Boris warmed up the plane's engines on shore, watched by a cluster of admiring children. I knelt with my fingers in my ears, a few feet from the right wingtip. Through the cockpit window, I could see the intent faces of Boris and his co-pilot. Their eyes checked instruments on the panel. Their lips moved in a mysterious technical jargon I could not hear. Their hands reached up to adjust a wondrous galaxy of switches and levers. First one motor, then the other, gave out a long, shattering roar, so loud you felt as if you were standing inside the noise. The aircraft rocked and strained at its wheels. The saplings at the edge of the forest behind it bent toward the ground. Finally, the engines quieted to a powerful whoosh. Boris released the brakes, and the plane rolled down the ramp into the water. He taxied out to the middle of the lake, the propellers blowing a wet wind back over us on shore. Suddenly, a great white tail of spray spread out behind the plane. Its wheels now folded into its belly, the Mallard lifted higher and higher in the water, transformed into a shape of sleek grace. A motorboat or two raced alongside, then were quickly left behind. At last, triumphantly, the plane broke free of the water and rose into the dusk. The engine's roar echoed off the lake. The very mountains vibrated. A plume of water drops trailed from the fuselage, then faded to a fine mist, then to nothing. On the ground, people began quietly talking again, moving slowly, reluctantly, toward the waiting cars. High in the sky, Boris dipped a wing and turned toward New York.
Adam Hochschild is an author and co-founder of Mother Jones Magazine. He teaches writing at the University of California, Berkeley. And that's it. Another year's worth of news of the world, large scale and intimate, told in stories at the 2004 Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism. Special thanks to Mark Kramer at the Nieman Foundation and to Buck Ewing at Cambridge Transcriptions. For more information about the Nieman Conference or to listen to the readings we've shared, visit our website at onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Lauren Madelon, and Tim Scope. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Asprey. This is On Point.